The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
The Crossman Conversation is hosted by John Crossman. John's heart is to see our community of leaders unite around what we have in common. John will be joined by political leaders, religious leaders, as well as activists making a difference in our nation. Here is your host for the Crossman Conversation, John Crossman.
Hello, this is John Crossman, and welcome to the Crossman Conversation. Mike, I need to open up with a quick story. I hope you're okay with that.
Yeah, I'm always okay with your stories.
I appreciate this quick story, Mike. Well, Mike, this story actually kind of impacts you a little bit. I don't know if you know this, but I know that one of my favorite movies of all time, it's a cinematic gem. It's called Ron Burgundy, Anchorman. You familiar with that? And Mike, you were on a news show in the 70s. I've seen photos. Yeah. I've seen photos of you.
I have a photo of me that people tell me it looks like Ron Burgundy.
It does.
Because I used to have a mustache. Yeah.
So you're feeling that vibe. Well, yeah. One of my favorite Ron Burgundy scenes and quotes, you know, there's a lot of spoofing on the 70s. And one of the things is they start talking about diversity. And that was a very new concept then. And so they're in the big production meeting and somebody starts talking about diversity. And then one of the guys like, well, what the heck is diversity? And Ron Burgundy says, well, I could be wrong, but I believe diversity is an old, old wooden ship that was used during the Civil War era. That's what he says in response to that. And so I'm so happy because diversity is not an old wooden ship. It's a very important topic. And today we have a global expert on the topic, and we have Zing Shaw here with us, and she is the global leader for ZRG Partners in the areas of diversity, equity, inclusion. So Zing, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, gentlemen.
Well, my first question for you, Zing, is I want to know this. I was thinking about this morning. What if I'm for diversity and inclusion, but I don't like equity? Can I pick two of the three, or do I really have to be pro all three? Is that a thing?
I mean, listen, you have to be all three.
Oh, okay.
You can't have diversity without inclusion because that's just representation.
Okay.
You can't have inclusion without diversity because you might have a homogenous culture of everyone who's the same and feels included, but you don't have any difference in the equation. And then equity, for me, that's the magic sauce right there. That's the piece that ensures that we are providing resources and tools to everyone so that we can meet them where they're at. Give them the things that they need, not necessarily create cookie cutter programs and resources that everybody can tap into, but getting very specific into the needs of each individual so that they can reach their maximum potential. So when you're utilizing all three of those things together, that's when you're going to create a high performing organization or team.
Gotcha. Now, listen, I have one way I'd refer to this. You know, I was joking with you a little bit there, a little joking. But this is a serious thing, and I want to say it, and I say this a lot, and I want you to respond back to that. So sometimes when I'm talking to crowds, I say, listen, when we talk about diversity and equity inclusion, we're not talking about lowering the bar. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about widening the net. And I always joke about it as like, do you think the 1965 University of Alabama football team was the best representation of the athletic ability in the state of Alabama? And the answer is no. It wasn't until 1971 when USC came to town and beat them that all of a sudden it was like, well, maybe we shouldn't have an all-white football team here. And so the team got better, right? And so if we take that into this place of business, if we want to have a great business, we want a great sales staff, or we want to have a great law firm and have all kinds of great lawyers, you know, when we have a wider net, we have more people at the table, We in turn get the best talent. And it goes beyond that. We better connect with our clients. We better connect with the community. It makes us better, more profitable. Am I right? Is that the right? Am I on the right path when I say that?
You're 100% correct. I always tell everyone, diversity does not equal deficiency. And the reason I say that is because there are oftentimes situations where I'm talking with clients and they say, listen, we would love a diverse hire, but we have to ensure that they are actually good at the job. And so I'm always baffled when I hear that feedback because I have to let my clients know, well, quality is the number one thing that we're going for. We're always going to have a high bar for talent. We're always looking for the highest quality of talent. So diversity, to your point, is just widening the net, but it is not asking for a compromise on that talent level. I also use an analogy that I think you might enjoy. I talk about apple picking, going to an apple orchard. Sometimes people are looking for talent like going to an apple orchard. You pick a Macintosh or a green apple or a Granny Smith or a red apple, and you put all of these apples into your basket, but they're still apples, right? They're apples. And so if you get to the end of the experience and you go to check out and say, okay, I'm ready to purchase my apples, someone might throw an orange and say, hey, here's an orange. I want you to consider this. And so you might look at the orange and say, well, how much does it cost? Or what does it taste like? Or what is the value in me bringing this home? Because I really came here looking for apples. And ultimately, you may not purchase that orange because you were apple picking. What I want to do through diversity, equity, and inclusion work is to create a fruit basket. People should be thinking about strawberries, grapes, oranges, apples, bananas, pears. We've got to create an ecosystem where clients get comfortable understanding that we may not throw you a traditional candidate. You know, if you're looking for a candidate that only came out of the finance sector and only went to an Ivy League school, that's being narrow. And so I might throw some candidates at you that have disparate experiences, but don't forget, the bar is always set high in terms of quality. And so think, you know, getting people to wrap their mind around the concept that we can't go apple picking anymore. We've got to create an ecosystem for a fruit basket.
Gotcha. So let me throw this at you. Okay. So in my life, when I'm doing life and doing things, I like rare to never do I ever hear somebody and I say, oh my gosh, I think that dude's a racist. Like when I was a kid, I would hear things people saying, and I would think that guy's a racist. But as an adult, I don't really hear that vernacular ever. And I'm grateful that I don't hear that kind of stuff. But what I do hear, and I don't know if there's a better word to use, but what I do hear a lot of still is elitism. And what I define that, what I mean is like, oh, well, you know, my kid's going to the University of blank. And then if you reference a community college, it's definitely perceived as less than. Or if you say a black college, it's perceived as less than. And to me, it's like, I feel like elitism and racism are like roommates. You know, they're pretty close, you know. So I'll give you an example, and I like your response to it. So in downtown Orlando is the FAMU College of Law, and it's the most diverse law school in America. And 80% of black judges in America went to an HBCU, and 20% of all black lawyers went to one of six law schools, and we have one of them in Orlando. And so FAMU College of Law graduates more black lawyers every semester than all their state law schools, state of Florida combined. But I still meet some law firms that say, oh, no, no, we only recruit from Florida State and the University of Florida, even when they're based in downtown Orlando, right? And I'm like, guys, like, you would swear you're not a racist, but by saying what you're saying, you're eliminating a massive pool of applicants. And by the way, they may be some of your best hires. Does that articulate well? Is my message correct? Or do you have comments on that, please?
I have a great comment for that. And I appreciate you sharing that story because I think that happens more often than not. I think back in the 60s when my parents were growing up, and they happened to be two African-American educators, but when they were growing, one was from the North and one was from the South, and they had very different experiences. But I think at the core of their experiences were, I would say, heightened race relations that could perhaps be negative experiences in their lives. And so when you tell me that story, it resonates so deeply with me, because I think that in the past, we used very overt racist language. So you would hear people in the 60s and 70s say the N-word and not flinch an eye. And so that is not popular to do anymore, but yet there are still microaggressive behaviors like only selecting from an Ivy when you have a historically black college in the same city that is also has available talent. And so it may be an undercover way of getting to the goal of homogeneity without being overtly expletive in the language that is being used. So you have to really look at the actions versus the words at this point.
I like that. You know, I sometimes Mike and I were just hanging out and talking about a couple of fun, hard topics. We like to solve the world's problems when we're hanging out. But one of the things I was saying to Mike, I said, you know, sometimes what I look at is like, it's about money and power. And so sometimes people just go to their alma mater because they want to promote their alma mater because it's about money and power. Like, that's what's going on there. And, you know, is that, quote, racist? Like, well, I don't know that's directly, but it certainly can be part of the greater problem, right? And
absolutely.
Right. So that can be a thing. So one of the things that we did was, you know, we've endowed scholarships at Bethune-Cookman and FAMU and Jackson State and done a thing with North Carolina Central because we're big HBCU fans around here. We went ahead and created a Fulbright scholarship at the University of Florida for a master's in real estate, so long as you went undergrad to an HBCU. And so we have a young lady going through the program right now. She graduated from FAMU, and so we'll have future students going through that. And so that's been kind of a fun way to do that. And I'm a trustee at Bethune-Cookman University, and one of my fellow trustees, he did the same thing, except he one-upped me. He quanned up me, or quan, I don't know the word for five. He has five Fulbright scholarships at University of Florida College of Law if you went to an HBCU undergrad. So I think there's ways you can still benefit your alma mater. You can still say, hey, I still love, you know, the University of Michigan or East Alabama or, you know, San Diego State, wherever you're from and across the country, but you can create a bridge, right, that creates that kind of connectivity. So there are some solutions. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely right. And first of all, thank you for supporting historically Black colleges and universities. I happen to be an alumna of Spelman College, which is a historically Black college in Atlanta, Georgia. And it's unique because it is an all-women's college. And so there are only two HBCUs that are all-women's colleges. Spelman happens to be one of them. And it was such a great experience going there. I also sit on the board of trustees of Fisk University,
awesome.
Which is a historically Black college in Nashville, Tennessee.
Sure.
And the home of the late W.E.B. Du Bois and so many scholars that came out of that experience. And so I love the intentionality that you have used in order to ensure that these students are getting opportunities. I would also just take it a step further and say that there should also be a mechanism for identifying Black and brown talent at predominantly white institutions. And the reason I say that is because I have a lot of colleagues and people that I have been engaged with throughout the course of my career in all of the places that I've served. I was the chief diversity officer at Starbucks at one point. I was the chief diversity officer at Marsh McLennan, the largest reinsurance industry. Company in the industry. I was the chief diversity officer in the National Basketball Association representing the Atlanta Hawks. And so I would say through all of those experiences, I've realized that there are Black and brown talent that come out of universities that are not necessarily historically Black. And so while the intentionality that you have is very focused and certainly creating a critical mass of people to be looked at, we also have to hold predominantly white institutions accountable for creating an ecosystem where their Black and brown talent can also be looked at.
We got to take a break. So cliffhanger here. But we'll come back at the Cross Conversation talking to Zing Shaw about diversity, equity, inclusion. So we'll be right back.
Here's a call to those who want to make an impact on their company, their community, or who possess a desire to make the world a better place. Crossman Career Builders provides the tools and resources for you or your company to make a difference on some of the toughest issues that we all face. Crossman Career Builders partners with CEOs, politicians, and pastors seeking to address problems of racism, mental health, addiction, justice, and suicide. CrossmanCB.com.
Once again, here is John Crossman.
All right, Zing, I want to keep talking to you. You were just talking about what some people refer to as PWIs, which would stand for predominantly white institutions, which is, you know, colleges that, you know, historically have had a lot of white students in it. And so we endowed a real estate scholarship at FSU, and our focus is students who are Black, Hispanic women or members of the Seminole tribe, because that connection. And then we endowed the first ever scholarship at Valencia College, which was formerly a community college, for students of Hispanic descent who are looking in to get into real estate. And so I really hear you on that. I take that very seriously. And I think more universities are getting better at that. Having a daughter who's a high school senior and another daughter that's a high school junior, you know, we really did a long look at colleges. And my big thing is helping them find the right places for them. And then the next step is making sure they're successful at those schools. And so that's kind of what I hear you saying is like, we need to have right places, good places for lots of kids, and then make sure that once they're there, the resources. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. That's absolutely what I'm saying.
Well, Zing, now tell me this. Like, you went undergrad to this awesome college. I mean, Spelman, you know, that is a household name and one of these best colleges. And then you went to this other school, and it's in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure. I've not really heard of it. What is it?
The University of Pennsylvania.
That's where Paterno was? I don't know what you're talking about. Is that? Oh, I'm teasing. You went to the University of Pennsylvania, which is an Ivy League school. I've actually lectured there. It's like every building looks like a castle. It's unbelievable. So you went to this.
It's gorgeous.
Oh, you went to super prestigious undergrad, and then you went to like a more prestigious for graduate school. What was that like going from this one all female super thing to this Ivy League, you know, world renowned university? What was that like?
I would say it was the most enlightening experience for me to have both of those experiences. When I went to Spelman, people assumed that it was just, you know, a group of homogenous women, you know, we're all Black, and so we must all be the same. And what I learned in that experience is that we're not. I had friends from the West Coast. I happened to be a native New Yorker. We met girls that were from Ghana, people that were from parts of South America and all over the world. And we all had very different lived experiences. Some of us came from extremely affluent households where parents were millionaires. Others came from experiences where they didn't have parents. They were in the foster care system and had to really struggle to get to school. And so I realized that just because people look the same doesn't mean they are the same. Now, I would say University of Pennsylvania was a very different experience for me because it was, I would say, extremely global in nature. So there are a lot of students from Penn that come from all over the world, but historically, they are European-facing countries, and there was a critical mass of white students. And it was a hard experience for me to transition into because I'll never forget my first class. We were, you know, talking about the syllabus, and the professor was going over what we would be tackling the semester. And I remember being asked a question by one of my fellow classmates. She was a white woman, and she asked me about how Black people think about whatever the topic was that we were talking about. And so I had to explain to her that I can only give her my experience around the topic. I don't know how Black people think about the topic because there's a lot of different types of Black people. And so you might get a lot of different opinions from them regarding what we're talking about. And then after class, she approached me and she said something very hurtful. She said, you know, I think you're only here to fill a quota.
Oh,
and I'm not sure that you're here. Because that's... you're actually good. But it was such a great experience because it made me buckle down. I probably worked harder at Penn than I did at Spelman because I wanted to prove that I was not there to fill a quota, but I was there because I was smart and I was capable and I was deserving. And so I ended up getting a 4.0 that semester.
Well,
and I proved everybody and all of the dissenters wrong. But I definitely feel that I had very different experiences. I was very nurtured at Spelman. I was loved. My professors are still in my life, some of them to this day. Penn was more transactional, was definitely rigorous, and it gave me, I would say, a better world view of the challenges that I would be facing in corporate America.
Well, can I just first say, I'm really sorry that happened to you. I'm really sorry that woman said that to you. And I don't like that woman. I just want to say that. I don't even know who she is. I don't like her. She's off my list. I don't like that lady.
Don't dislike her. She didn't know.
Well,
you know, listen, I appreciate her being honest about her feelings. You know, sometimes people hide and mask these feelings when you're at work. They have them in their heart and you don't know. And so when you, as a person of color, have experiences in the workplace that are, I would say, less than desirable, you may not realize that you are the target of someone's deep, deep, deep prejudice or subconscious, unconscious feelings around race. So I actually was grateful that she spoke out loud, because then I knew how to have conversations with her and how to perhaps help her see another way.
Listen, you're not going to convince me. I don't like her. Okay, we're just going to change subjects. Like, I don't like her. Well, you know, one of the things you said that is so true, and I say this a lot, is like black and black's not the same thing. White and white's not the same thing. Hispanic and Hispanic's not the same thing. I mean, somebody from Mexico and somebody from Puerto Rico doesn't mean that they're going to be buddies, right? And somebody's black and they could be from Detroit. Someone else is from, you know, you said Ghana or something like that. Not the same thing. And like, look, I have a lot of white family members that are from the Midwest that are lower income, and they don't identify with somebody that's descended from the British living in Boston, right? So you're right about that, all that complication there. So we've only got a few minutes left, and I want to ask you this question. Visualize with me if there was, like, you were sitting side by side with me, and there's like 60 white middle-aged CEOs, kind of look like me, but I want you to go with me on this one. They're good guys. These are good guys, okay? They want to get it right. And they look at you and they're like, hey, you're this expert. I really want my company to be a good company that's doing the right things. You, as a very impressive woman who's black, who's an expert in these topics and has a global view of the world, like all these things, what advice would you want them? What would you want them to know and be thinking about?
Well, I love the question, because this just happened 3 days ago. I'm a member of an organization called YPO, which stands for Young Presidents Organization. And everyone in the organization is either a president or a CEO of a company. And as you can imagine, I am in my cohort the only black woman. And so we just met with each other face to face in Nashville, Tennessee a few days ago. And some of those questions were directed towards me. And my response is always the same. If you really want to lean into diversity, equity, and inclusion work, you have to go on a learning journey for yourself. And that doesn't mean watching a PowerPoint presentation or taking an unconscious bias training. Mm-hmm. It means on a Saturday, take yourself to a community in your local neighborhood that is perhaps marginalized communities, people of color in the community. Go somewhere uncomfortable. You know, find friends or find people that you can interact with who are completely different than you, especially if they are racially different than you, and ask them to spend time and to talk and to learn about their life and their experiences and teach them about yours. But you have to, you can't be a diversity, equity, and inclusion leader if you're not doing this in your day-to-day life.
Right.
You have to give to the homeless. You have to help others, and you have to meet people where they're at. Once you're able to do that, then you'll start to build a muscle that is going to translate into the way that you treat people at work.
I've been asked to facilitate as part of a greater group about some really hard topics in our community, and, you know, education, homelessness, everything you just kind of talked about. And so we did a training thing yesterday to kind of prepare us for us. And they asked Q&A, and I said, listen, I want to share a fear I have. And in the last 18 months in my community, I've been involved with two other events like that, that were diversity, equity, inclusion events. And when I heard the person leading each of these two events, when they got done Q&A, I said, are Trump supporters included in this? And both times I was told no. And I was like, well, I don't even know what, you know. And so with this group I was just with, they were like, yes, like, you know, truly. And so to me, it's like, that's a big part of it to what you're saying, is like, you know, being open to have different people that view things differently, and will have pause and time and really seek to understand, right? But if we exclude absolutely any one group, it's like we're kind of missing the point. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Well, you are delightful. I want to have you back because I want to talk about, oh, I don't know, the NFL, the NBA. I want you to create a list for me of the top five coolest people in one. If you had to make them fight each other, which two would you make fight? You must have some cool, your HR stories have got to be hilarious. I mean, I know you can't tell them, but you maybe change the names, like Jordan Feichel or something. One time you saw, I don't know, but you must have some crazy stories, I bet. Right?
All my HR stories could be a New York Times bestseller. I'm sure of it.
Oh my gosh, HR people, they have the coolest, interesting lives. They just can't talk about them. Well, thank you so much, Zing Shaw, who is really doing cool, interesting work. And I encourage people to follow her on social media. If you ever need a guest lecturer on this important topic, bring her in. Her experience and breadth of knowledge is amazing. ZRG Partners. And thank you for being on the Crossman Conversations. And we're a fan of what you're doing, and we appreciate you so much.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Mike. It's been my pleasure.
Nice to talk to you.
And so thank you so much for listening to Crossman Conversation. And as I always say, Zing, support your local HBCU.
This has been Crossman Conversation, produced by a Crossman Career Builders Mark Radio Production.